Yes, I am. I hear you clearly.
Great. Thank you. Just to mention again, we've actually had a series of conversations here with Professor Wolf, one on the changes that are happening vis-a-vis the United States and Cuba, relations thereof, and the effects that those might have on both economies. And then a second conversation where we focused on the issues having to do with our country's economic system, which is capitalism, the crisis that we're in, an analysis of some of the reasons for that, and a discussion, beginning of a discussion of some of the alternatives to capitalism, one of which we defined as socialism. And just to remind folks who Professor Richard Wolf is, he's a professor of economics emeritus at the University of Massachusetts for over three decades, visiting professor of economics in the graduate program for international affairs at New School University in New York. He's the author of many books and articles, and actually DVDs on the topic of the crisis in our economy, one of which is called Democracy at Work. I think that's the most recent one. And before that, Capitalism Hits the Fan, which is an analysis of the crisis that occurred in 2008 and kind of breaks it down and explains the root causes therein. So thank you once again, Richard, for joining us. We tonight are going to focus again on sort of some of the nuts and bolts issues having to do with what capitalism is and how socialism might play into changes that could occur in our economy and other economies. But just to remind you and others what we talked about last time, one of the things you said was you talked about the fundamentally undemocratic structure of corporations in which a board of directors who control the vast majority of stock and get to make the decisions that generally benefit their own interests rather than the lesser shareholders and the employees of the corporation. And this model results in extreme disparities in income, wherein officers of the large corporation earn hundreds of times more than the workers who actually produce the wealth of that corporation. You suggested as an alternative to that structure that workers' cooperatives or worker-owned corporations were an effective antidote to that orthodox capitalist model because the workers could make the decisions to more fairly distribute the profits that they generate through their labor. And then you also mentioned that you sort of hypothesized that there's less interest in a kind of macro solution to correct this economic inequality, which would one solution might be a socialist system at the kind of macro level from government level, as opposed to this micro solution which you proposed, which is at the workers' cooperatives. And you said that was because of the implosion of the Soviet Union and the Eastern European socialist bloc nations. So that's where the ground we covered last time. A lot more was covered as well. But those were some of the main points that were raised. And so I want to start with a question, which actually comes off that last point that you had raised. And that is, how can we address the gigantic global changes such as climate change, animal and plant species extinction, virulent diseases, systemic poverty, which are at a global level, but also obviously very intensely heated up at national levels? How can we address those without a planned, highly calibrated approach to production and distribution, i.e. a socialist system at the national level? I mean, I'm left with the feeling that I love the workers' cooperatives, but how are we going to get to solving these huge problems without actually having, you know, governments that attack them in very planned and calibrated ways, which would, I guess, sort of be moving toward a socialist model?
Yeah, I think that the whole reason that folks like me are focusing on worker cooperatives and getting workers to be the owners, operators, and above all, decision makers in enterprises large and small, not because we see that as an alternative to a coordinated nationwide or even international assault on the problems you list, but as an adjunct to that, as an addition to that. In other words, the idea, the original idea of socialism was to use the government as a way to make a transition from a private capitalist system where the decisions are made by private capitalists seeking profit for themselves and their shareholders, to a socialized system where the government, the theory went, would make decisions different from what private capitalists did, because they would be serving the population as a whole rather than the tiny minority of major shareholders, top executives, and all of that. And that was a very nice idea, made perfect sense. The weakness it showed in the history of the Soviet Union and China and so on was that if you give this enormous power to the government, you've got to be very careful to make sure that whatever that government does is accountable to and ultimately controlled by the mass of people at the bottom. Because if you don't do that, then you run the risk, which the history of the Soviet Union shows, that a government with the power to make a transition can kind of abort that transition halfway through, get rid of the private capitalists, all right, but instead of really owning and operating it in the name of the people as a whole, to begin to operate it in the interests of the people who own and operate the government. And so my interest in worker co-ops, being the situation where workers as a group control the enterprises, is that in the end, the only way the government can function is if the enterprises provide them with the tax revenues and other means to carry out government policy. If the workers are put in charge of the businesses so that the government either taxes the workers' income or taxes the income of the enterprise, which the workers in a worker co-op would control, then finally you would have a government that could address these big problems you list, but would at the same time be ultimately and in the most important way, namely economically, dependent on and accountable to the workers at the base of society, because they would all be grouped in the workplaces where they do their labor as the owners and operators and the ones who in the end deliver the taxes without which the government can't do anything anyway. So that was, it was the idea that workers' co-op is what was missing from the efforts to create socialism and needed to be added to that so that the promise of socialism, namely that an economy works for the people as a whole rather than for the minority who own the businesses and run the boards of directors, this idea still has lots of value, but we have to learn from where it fell short, and adding worker co-op to it is a way to make sure that what happened in the Soviet Union that wasn't good isn't repeated the next time people have had it up to here with capitalism, which is precisely what is developing here in the United States now with the crisis since 2008.
So I guess the follow-up question is, how does this micro approach within a capitalist system actually reach the level where there is a transformation instead of being just kind of these sort of role model situations, like let's say we said single payer healthcare in Vermont, if it were to come about, could be a model that would attract other participants, other states who wanted to say, well, that's working really well, let's do that. These worker co-ops, were they successful, might attract other groups of workers to try to set up these co-ops within their work system, work situations.
Exactly. And that, I mean, let me give you a couple of examples of how it might work. I meet occasionally with labor unions. And if you know much about labor unions in the United States, for the last 30, 40 or more years, many of them have constantly confronted the following situation. The employer comes to see them one morning and says, look, I'm thinking of moving my factory or my office or my store out of this city or out of this state or even out of the country. And I'm going to do that because it's more profitable for me unless you make it worth my while to stay here. And the only way you workers can do that is if you're willing to work at lower wages, for longer hours, without job security, without benefits, et cetera, et cetera. And the unions are terrified. They don't know what to do. They try as best they can to limit the amount of concessions, they're called, that they have to make to the employer in order to hold on to their jobs, which is what they're concerned about. Well, I say to them, this is a losing proposition. The best you can get in that situation is less in the way of givebacks to the employer than the employer initially demanded, but you're still losing. You're just not losing as badly as the employer initially proposed. Here's an alternative. You say to the employer, go away. Go already. Go to your other country. Go to your other state. What we're going to do the minute you leave, we're going to convert this business that you've abandoned to make more money for yourself into a workers' co-op. We're going to say to the workers, you know how to produce. You've been working here for a long time. We don't need this boss. We can boss ourselves. And we're going to do a workers' co-op. We're going to go to the local politicians and say, give us some help. Give us some money. Give us some legal changes that will make it easier for us to work as a workers' co-op. Because if you do, you'll be the hero politician that kept the jobs in this community for people and that kept the revenue flowing to the local city or town that comes from having workers in a position of earning money at a job, etc., etc. And if you don't help us, dear politician, we will explain that to the constituents that you allowed this company to leave and did not help worker co-op to replace it, and you won't get elected to be dog catcher in the future because you will have failed this community that you're supposed to serve. That would be a very powerful alternative, and it would mean that all over the United States, worker co-ops could be developed they would be developed instead of seeing communities decimated by the departure of companies that used to be there, jobs that used to be there. Detroit is the great example of that happening in the United States. But the city of Baltimore, which blew up a couple of weeks ago, is the same story. Once upon a time in the late 60s and 70s, Bethlehem Steel was a major producer there. They decided to pull up stakes, close down their factories to make more money someplace else. And that decimated that city, and it has never really recovered from that because nobody had the idea, the commitment, the drive to say, wait a minute, we can continue to produce all kinds of things. We don't need the capitalist because we can do without him. What we could never do without is the workers, and that's what we've got here. Let's work with that. And I think if you began to build across the United States worker co-ops, for example, in this situation when workers are confronted with employers who threaten them basically with loss of job if they don't make concessions, that you would begin what I think would be a major social movement and a major social change in the United States. I think the simplest way to put it that I know how is this. You go to most workers and you say to them, look, we're going to give you a choice. You can go to work in a regular capitalist enterprise. You know what it's like. You arrive 5 days a week, 9 to 5. You do what you're told. There's some supervisor or foreman or a manager or executive who tells you what to do. You work all day, you go home, and you watch TV until you come back the next day and do it all again. All the basic decisions of your job are made by the bosses, whoever they are, the board of directors, the supervisors, the executives. You live with the results, you do what you're told, or else you're fired. Or you could work in a workers' co-op. there, not only will you have your particular job to do, but you'll be part of the group of workers, because that's what a democratic enterprise is, that makes all the decisions. You won't be hired by the managers. Instead, the managers will be hired by you, because the ultimate authority, the ultimate ownership, the ultimate decision-making is lodged democratically with the workers. I think most American workers, if given half a shot at such an opportunity, would vote with their feet. They would much prefer to work in a cooperative way with other workers, having the authority and the power that they've never seen before, rather than committing their lives to doing work they don't know for how long, they don't know what security they have, they don't know what kind of work they'll ever be asked to do. They're at the beck and call of other people over whom they exercise no control. It's the opposite of democracy, and my guess is if we once get a momentum of building worker co-ops in these and other ways, that they will quickly realize that they want and need a larger social institution, call it the government, call it the state, call it whatever you want, that is controlled by these co-ops but is subordinate to them, because its job is really to coordinate these co-ops so that together they can solve the list of problems with which you began today's program.
We are speaking with Professor Richard Wolff, who is a visiting professor of economics in the graduate program for international affairs at New School University. This conversation started several months ago. We're continuing it for the third time tonight. I want to ask one more question on this trend, this issue of the collapse or implosion, as you put it, of the socialist economies of the Soviet Union, right, and Eastern Bloc countries. I wonder, did socialism get a fair test? You know, I mean, was it a laboratory experiment without all kinds of impinging variables that sort of polluted the experiment? In other words, Soviet Union in the early days after the revolution invaded by European countries, and I think the United States participated in that. That was before the invasion by Germany during World War II, when the tens of millions of Russians were killed. The economy and country were basically destroyed completely. Take examples of the example of Cuba and maybe even Venezuela. Cuba, has been under embargo from the United States, its largest trading power, a partner for more than 50 years. So, I mean, I'm wondering, how do we know how those countries, how socialism would have occurred, how it would have unfolded and evolved as a potential viable solution to the problems we're talking about of unequal distribution of wealth at all?
Right. It's a very, very good question. I would even add, if I might, another question. What about this constant talk that we hear that capitalism is a success and socialism was a failure? I think that's a mistake. Obviously, something was wrong with Soviet socialism, that it collapsed in 1989, and that the Soviet people seemed, in general, with some exceptions, to be pretty happy to see it go. That is a serious flaw in that system. There's no way out of that, and nor should anyone shy away from asking the basic question, why that happened. But to use the term in some general way, failure of the Soviet system, that strikes me as very strange. Yes, it disappeared, and that's serious. But let's take a look at what Soviet socialism, with all of its flaws, which eventually undid it, nonetheless, you can have all kinds of flaws, as Lord knows we do here in the United States, and yet still want to be able to point to things that are achievements, to things that are positive. And the Soviet socialist system, which I criticize, is nonetheless a system that has a lot going for it and achieved a lot. Let me just summarize. In 1917, when the Soviet Revolution occurs in a then capitalist Russia, the Soviet Union, or what was called Russia before the revolution happened, was the poorest country in Europe. It was a country in which the vast majority of people worked the land, were illiterate, were backward in every dimension one can think of relative to the rest of Europe. Not only was that the reality of their economic situation, but in 1917, when the revolution occurred, Russia had just lost its participation in World War I, where it had been devastated. But worse, it also suffered a civil war in 1918. It suffered, as you correctly pointed out, an invasion by four countries: Britain, France, the United States, and on the eastern side of the country, Japan. All four countries invaded the new Soviet Union to put down that revolution. So they had a revolution, a lost world war, they were the poorest country of Europe to begin with, and then they had a civil war. I mean, this is a completely devastated country in 1918, 1919. Very shortly thereafter, they had another world war, World War II, and you rightly point out that more Russians were killed than people of any other nationality in the devastation of that war. Nonetheless, by 1975, Russia was the second superpower after the United States. That's an unbelievable achievement. To have gone from one of the poorest countries of Europe to the big power that only the United States was stronger than, which was the case by 1975, was a proof that what the Soviet Union did, with all of its flaws and weaknesses, was, in terms of developing a modern industrial economy, a stunning success. And anyone who doesn't understand that is playing a game we used to call wishful thinking. You may not like the Soviet Union, but that's really no excuse for fooling yourself or others about what that society achieved. And by the way, the model of the Soviet Union, of a government that drives industrial development, has been copied in China. And that's why the People's Republic of China, which was even poorer than the Soviet Union when they had their revolution in 1949, is now the second superpower after the United States, too. So when it comes to economic development, when it comes to going from a poor country to a much, much, much less poor country, something that most of the countries on this planet would dearly love to do, then the Soviet brand of socialism and the Chinese brand of socialism have to be counted stunning successes, even though they had qualities which make us not want to replicate their particular experience, which is why I focus on worker co-ops, because in my theory or my understanding, that might be a way to get the benefits of the economic growth that Russia and China achieved without the overweening governmental power that was the deficit there, and that could be prevented if the government were made dependent on the people by putting the people in charge of the economic enterprises that produce the goods and services that everyone in such societies depends on.
Well, thank you for that history lesson and a reminder that not all our kind of black and white assessments of what wound up being the fate of the Soviet Union are accurate.
I mean,
to
make it as dramatic as possible, as little as 30 years ago, no American citizen who took off their clothes at night to get into bed the way we all do would have encountered the phrase "made in China" on virtually every piece of clothing, on many pieces of furniture, on many appliances that we use, etc. Today, a mere 30 years later, which isn't historically a long period of time, we take for granted that most of the objects we touch in a day were made in China, that hundreds of millions of Chinese peasants have moved to the cities, have become modern industrial workers, that they produce very high quality merchandise, that is replacing that from most other parts of the world, around the world. This is a stunning achievement in an incredibly short period of time, and there is no reason why the Chinese shouldn't be, as they indeed are, extremely proud of what they've achieved. That doesn't mean that everything there is perfect. It doesn't mean that we aren't entitled and indeed required to be critical of what they don't do well, but that is no warrant for pretending that they are anything other than a stunning example of what socialism can do, so that if you were able to make socialism democratic, that is, to really come up with a concrete way that what the socialist governments do is not only rapid economic development, but a proper giving to the mass of people the power, the authority, the civil liberties, the civil rights that a modern society wants and needs, if you could figure out how to do that, which is what we think worker co-ops provide us, then you could have the benefits of socialism without those defects which the early experiments with socialism, because that's what Russia and China are. They are the first experiments of the modern world. You don't make a change from one system to another all at once. You don't do it the first time you make the effort. China and Russia were the first ones, and presumably we're going to learn from their mistakes and do it better the second, third, and fourth time. And by the way, we will have opportunities to do it better. Why? Because the capitalist system that was so boastful about the collapse of the Soviet Union merely had about 10 years to go, or 15 after the collapse of the Soviet Union, before the capitalism we all live in now began the same kind of implosion on itself that affected the Soviet Union, which is why we're all discussing socialism right now.
Indeed. Thank you for that, Professor Wolf. I want to mention something that another thing that you talked about in our conversation a couple of months ago. You said that the driving force in a capitalist system is the quest for profits, and that this quest, it's amazingly, supersedes the quest to actually produce commodities that are needed by the society. In other words, the real goal is the profits. It's not they don't really care how they get them or
That's
how they
right.
make them. And so what happens is, generally speaking, a lot of companies start producing the same commodities. You get overproduction. Prices fall because there's too much stuff. Workers are laid off because prices fall, et cetera, et cetera. And these kind of crises happen all the time in socialism, in capitalism, sorry. And what I want to know is, because what we're going to try to get our conversation over to these global trade pacts that are looming before right. before us, that are being attempted to be fast-tracked through Congress. What I want to know is, when did the U.S. capitalism sort of turn its turrets, you know, its sights toward the global playing field, and how did they get from a very protectionist economy where goods produced in foreign countries had to pay high tariffs to be on the U.S. market? How did they get from there to a situation where it's no holds barred? You know, we got trade pacts coming down the pike every other month. We had NAFTA, followed by dozens of others, and now these two new ones about to happen, the Trans-Pacific Partnership and the Transatlantic Trade Investment Partnership. So can you kind of sort of take us from that high tariff period and just sort of tell us how it all came to be?
Absolutely. Yeah. I, you know, most of the questions you throw at me are really difficult. This one's a bit easier, so I'm grateful for it. Let me try to answer the way it went. Capitalism in the United States, like capitalism in Western Europe and the other places where it's strong, is really only 200 or 300 years old. Started in England, spread to Western Europe, and from there to North America, Japan, and eventually the rest of the world. In the places where it started, Western Europe, North America, Japan, the early places where capitalism really took off, in its first 100, 200 years, it concentrated, this successful capitalism, in the places where it was born. So that, for example, here in the United States, as capitalism grew, mostly in the 19th and 20th centuries, it was concentrated here in the United States. When a company grew, it expanded its factories and its offices here in the United States. It set up its storage facilities here in the United States. It arranged for stores to sell what they produced here in the United States. Everything was concentrated where the capitalism took root, where it grew, where it was born. But then in the 1970s, two things happened that made capitalists sit up and decide to change their strategy. The first was the jet engine, which made it possible for a capitalist to get anywhere on the earth, or a worker either for that matter, in a matter of hours through a jet plane. And the second big invention was the internet and telecommunications. Made it possible for a boss sitting in New York or Chicago or L.A. To be on top of what was going on thousands of miles away in a factory or an office through the marvels of modern instantaneous technology, telecommunications, and so on. And the reason I point to those is that the two of them together produced for many American capitalists what you might call one of those eureka moments, those moments when capitalists, many of them, more or less at the same time, realized something. And here's what they realized. With the jet engine and with the ability to control and monitor what production was going on thousands of miles away, they didn't need any more to stay in the same geographic areas where they were born. That is, you could be a capitalist in New York or Chicago or Atlanta or anywhere else, but you didn't need to produce in Georgia or New York or Illinois or nearby. Indeed, you didn't have to produce in the United States at all. You could control whatever you were doing far away. You could get to it. You could have your managers get to it. And then they said, and oh my God, if we moved production from where we have concentrated it and where over the years the labor unions were able to win decent wages for their workers that we pay, we don't have to do that anymore. We can move to another part of the United States now easily. We can move beyond the borders of the United States, where we can hire workers for a fraction of what it costs to pay Americans. Not only that, the rest of the world being much poorer than the United States or Western Europe, being desperate, therefore, to get jobs, is willing to give up on taxes, not to bother producers with environmental protection laws or limits on how many children they can hire, etc., etc. So it's a much friendlier rest of the world for capitalists in Western Europe, North America, and Japan than it would be if they stayed at home. So starting in the 1970s, to make a long story short, they left. They basically waved goodbye to the countries and the areas and the workers of the places of their birth, and they became international, multinational mega corporations with headquarters perhaps in New York and Chicago, but with more and more of their factories, their offices, their warehouses in other parts of the world. And they did that for the simple reason that it was more profitable, because the workers were cheaper, the costs of doing business cheaper, the ease with which you could get out of difficult government regulations simpler. And so that was the reason, and they left. I mean, the paradigm case here in the United States is the city of Detroit. In 1970, the center of our thriving capitalist system, the city to which American presidents brought foreign visitors to show them as a showcase look how successful this city is. 2 million people, for the first time, African Americans could be part of the trade union, the United Auto Workers, at that time the strongest union in the country. African Americans able to enjoy wage levels similar to those of white people, which we hadn't seen in this country before. So successful was Detroit that it developed a whole new music, the Motown sound, that changed the music of the entire world. So here was a successful capitalism. But starting in the 1970s, what I just described happened. The three car companies, General Motors, Ford, and Chrysler, decided they could make more money leaving Detroit, hiring workers first in the American South, then in Mexico and Canada, and now General Motors' biggest growth area is China. So what they've done is they've moved for profit reasons, and they've left behind something which can only be described as an unmitigated disaster. The population of Detroit today is 700,000 people. That is the majority of the 2 million who lived there in 1970 were driven out of their homes, driven out of their communities, their neighborhoods, their families, their churches, whatever meant something to them. They had to leave because there was no work. And the reason there was no work was not that there weren't cars to be produced, but because it was more profitable for the shareholders and the executives of those three companies, less than 100 people, when you put them all in one room, made a decision that destroyed one of the great cities of the United States. Detroit, by the way, today is in bankruptcy. It's the largest city ever to go into bankruptcy in the history of the United States. So I think what we're seeing and what we're living through is a decision by American capitalists to leave, to kiss the rest of us goodbye, if I can use that language, because they're going to make more money somewhere else. And they don't really care what happens here, whether their Detroit looks like a bombed-out area, which it does, or whether another abandoned city, Baltimore, blows up the way it did a few weeks ago. These are, for them, uninteresting questions. They're busy making money someplace else.
So this was all before NAFTA, and this was all before this multiplicity of trade pacts that came along, which codified this behavior, I guess, and sort of made it. I'm kind of amazed that, people in our government approved of this and codified it and sort of greased the wheels for it. And when you hear somebody like Barack Obama, who out of one side of his mouth says, you know, I would never sign a trade pact that didn't help the American worker. This is going to referring to the TPP, the Trans-Pacific Partnership. This is going to be great for us. This is, you know, all kinds of guarantees, no problems with regulations. And then on the other side of the coin, you hear progressives saying this is worse than NAFTA. So in our remaining minutes together, can you address these trade pacts with reference to NAFTA, the two that we mentioned, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, TPP, and the TTIP, which is the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership, that's primarily with European countries, European Union. Can you just give us your assessment of how these pacts fit into the trajectory of de-evolution that's been occurring, you know, in the American industrial base? And are these pacts worse, you know, better, or what? What's your assessment?
My assessment is these pacts are milestones in the road that I just finished describing. They are rearrangements of diplomacy, of relationships among countries, of economic rules of the game, designed to make it easier and cheaper for corporations to go global, to leave the United States, Western Europe, and Japan in order to find more profitable locations for their work on a global scale. And they don't want to be hampered by having all these little countries, each with its own rules, each with its own tax rates that they have to navigate. They're disgusted with it. They don't want to have to spend the money to navigate all these different things. They want a kind of unified situation that gives them maximum freedom of movement and maximum freedom to make the decision that's most profitable. And they will say to the politicians whom they need anything and everything necessary to get those politicians to give them what they want. When NAFTA was going through Congress, the then President Clinton made the same statements about his commitment to environmental protection, his commitment to workers' standards of work that Obama is making now. I'm not going to comment on whether these men knew or didn't know or do know what it is they're doing or not.